Thomas Pynchon is one of the most famous novelists in the world. Whole college courses are taught about his books Gravity's Rainbow, V, and The Crying of Lot 49. You'd think, in this age of social networks and increasing digital transparency, you'd think we'd know what Thomas Pynchon looks like, wouldn't you? We don't. You can find his 1953 high school yearbook picture online, and a few others. Of course, there's no photo on the dust jacket of Pynchon's new novel, Bleeding Edge, either. But a speculative rendering of Pynchon, who is now 76, accompanies Boris Kachka's story On the Thomas Pynchon Trail, published online at vulture.com. Kachka talks with Steve Paulson about the life and work of this famously reclusive writer.
Boris, is the publication of a new Thomas Pynchon novel still a literary event?
Not as much as it was when he hadn't written a novel for 17 years and Vineland came out. Probably not as much as when Mason Dixon came out and it was his first and most coherent historical novel and people were wondering what he was going to do with it. I still think it is, though. I think that there is enough of a fan base, and really there's no voice like his that people always want to know. Certain people always want to know what he's up to.
When you say there's no voice like his, what do you mean? What makes Thomas Pynchon special, unique?
I think anytime you have a unique voice and you really try to break it down, it tends to come down to a unity of contradictions. And I think with him, you've got the sacred and the profane. To do my story, I had to go back and reread Gravity's Rainbow, and I was astonished and embarrassed to be reading scenes in public of orgies. And then right after that, you have a profound meditation on the political forces that shape our lives. You're not going to get that from one book or from one author in too many places. And he's just hands down, sentence by sentence, a wonderful writer, too.
Well, let's talk some about his brand new novel, which is called Bleeding Edge, which you have described as a grizzled wanderer's wary truce with New York conformity and life in public. What do you mean?
I hope that doesn't sound reductive because I was approaching it from a biographical perspective. There are a lot of ways that you can read this new book if you choose to read it. But one of them, I think, is that he's writing about a very recent past in a place where he currently lives. This is someone who, for many, many years, for decades, made a point of not letting anyone know where he lived, including his agent at times. And now he's making these pop references. He's writing about, in some cases, the building where he lived. If you know the city at all, you can pretty much pinpoint almost the apartment that he lived in 3 or 4 years ago.
Well, he lives on New York's Upper West Side now, right?
Yes, he does. Mm-hmm. But he's switched around a little bit. But more importantly than these physical locations, I think, is that especially in these scenes where you have a sort of idea of escape or refuge and also the idea of being safe and home and keeping the children safe, I think it doesn't take too much of a leap to knowing that he has a child, that he sends his child to the best schools, but that he also has this very anarchic sensibility and that he has lived out that anarchism for decades before settling down in New York. I don't think it takes much to read into it his own struggles and contradictions and trying to make an accommodation with a life and a family, having wandered for so long.
Well, can you give us a brief outline of the storyline of Bleeding Edge?
I think that's the hardest question you're going to ask me. Essentially, I think I have to reread it, but Maxine Tarnow, who's a fraud detective on the Upper West Side, she somehow catches on to an investigation of this company called Hashslingers. This is right after the Silicon Alley 1.0 bust that hit New York and several months before 9/11. And she catches on to this villainous guy, Gabriel Ice, a sort of Jeff Bezos on crack. And there's something going on where he's manipulating hackers and buying up all this broadband. And he has some kind of plan to funnel money between different countries. Before and after September 11th occurs, it may somehow be tied in with that. There's a sort of play with red herrings and conspiracy theories. In the long run, I think it's about a time and a place right before 9/11, and it's also about paranoia and the idea that basically other people whose motives you don't understand want to control you, and that, I think, is true of this book and of Gravity's Rainbow and of V and of every single one of his books.
So this book is dealing with two historical events, really. One is 9/11, and the other is kind of the earlier days of the internet, and it would seem that both of these subjects play very well into what we think about as Thomas Pynchon's passions. I mean, paranoia, you've already mentioned, conspiracy, stuff happening underneath the surface. He's created the perfect tableau to deal with the subjects he loves.
Yes, and it's also a time of confusion. And I think the state of a Pynchon novel is always a state of confusion because although he plays with conspiracy theories, he never provides any answers. And I think for all the knowledge that is poured into his books, that's the emotional heart of his books, is the feeling that other people know more than you do, and they control your actions and manipulate you. And that's why most of his books are sort of thrillers in a way. This is a guy who was playing with circuit boards in the early 70s, late 60s, and has always been fascinated by computers. If you go back to Crying of Lot 49 in 1966, he was comparing a city's layout to a circuit board, and he's always been fascinated by both the freedom and the capacity for surveillance and control that the coming digital revolution was offering.
Well, it's funny to talk about these things now, and given the recent revelations from Edward Snowden and WikiLeaks and all of that. Pynchon is right there with us, with the current news.
Yeah, I wonder whether he made any last-minute changes. It's hard to say, but there is a prescience there that you can't deny.
In the novel, he talks about something called the deep web. Can you explain what that is?
The deep web is the ungoogleable internet, essentially. Hard for me to say whether it exists anymore. Maybe you'd have to ask him, but it certainly did back then. And I think what it was, and there was another part of it called Deep Archer, Departure, but also Deep Archer, that was basically like a SimCity type game. Both of these places were refuges from Google, from the corporate world, and very much the most lyrical sections of the book are set there.
So the idea is that there is this whole layer of the web that is beyond what ordinary people can get at. No search engine, Google or anything else can get you there, but some people have access to it.
Well, it's an interesting way of thinking about it because I think in the book it's framed as a place of freedom, but freedom for those who know about it, who are clued into it. Again, I hate to keep referring back to other books, but Tristero, whether it exists or not in the world of Crying of Lot 49, is very similar. It's an alternative to the U.S. postal system that's run by sort of homeless couriers. So that's a secret world of escape and freedom from the corporate forces around you. And I think that's how he saw Deep Web.
Originally, the guys, you have to wonder how presciently, had it in mind to create a virtual sanctuary to escape to from the many varieties of real-world discomfort. A grand-scale motel for the afflicted, a destination reachable by virtual midnight express from any place with a keyboard. Creative differences arose, to be sure, but went strangely unacknowledged. Justin wanted to go back in time to a California that had never existed. Safe, sunny all the time, where, in fact, the sun never set, unless somebody wanted to see a romantic sunset. Lucas was searching for someplace, you could say, a little darker, where it rains a lot and great silences sweep like wind, holding inside them forces of destruction. What came out as synthesis was Deep Archer. Whoa, Cinerama here. Cute, huh? Verva, switching on a gigantic 17-inch LCD monitor. Brand new, retails for about $1,000, but we got price. You're assimilating. Maxine, meantime, reminding herself that she has never had a clear idea of how these guys make their money.
Of course, Thomas Pynchon is not the only reclusive writer in the news these days. I mean, the late J.D. Salinger was, you know, famous, of course, for his privacy, and... Well, Salinger, I mean, he was always described as a recluse. Is Pynchon a recluse, as far as we know?
Well, he has been both self-mocking about it. In The Simpsons, there's a portrayal of him with a paper bag over his head.
Here's your quote. Thomas Pynchon loved this book almost as much as he loves cameras. Hey, over here, have your picture taken with a reclusive author. Today only, we'll throw in a free autograph. But wait, there's more.
Do we know why Thomas Pynchon is so obsessed with privacy? I mean, to the point where there is no acknowledged photograph of him since when? Since he was a teenager?
It's a big, big question. And is it political or is it psychological? Is it the belief that the writer's words should stand for themselves? I think he believes that. I think he also believes that being outside the grid is important. I think that he is deeply psychologically afraid of having his picture taken, which probably has something to do with his teeth. I think there's a sort of WASP reserve that somehow comes into it, which is actually something he probably has in common with his family, even though for so many years he was sort of running away from his family and his background. It's all of those things. It may be related to some trauma he had as a child, which I heard a little bit about. Maybe I'm being overly psychological here, but I think there must be something psychological at the heart of it.
What's your sense of how people will think about Thomas Pynchon in future years, 20 years from now, 50 years from now? Will he be remembered?
It's really difficult to say when you're close to it, when he's still around. But the stuff I said about the contradictions of his writing, I think there are things that he's done that are unique to him, and he's a unique and outstanding voice. And I think that that is the surest way to immortality. So I wouldn't be surprised if he outlasts Salinger.
Boris Kachka is the author of On the Thomas Pynchon Trail, a story published on Vulture.com. We've linked to it on our website, ttbook.org. Kachka is also the author of Hot House, The Art of Survival and the Survival of Art, at America's most celebrated publishing house, Farrar, Straus & Giroux. He spoke with Steve Paulson.